Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that gives us an opportunity to meet people who make a difference in our communities and in our lives. Our guests are Al Cobine, saxophonist, singer, arranger, composer, and big band director, and former politician. He is here with his wife, Marion, and for the next hour or so, we'll ask a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Al, Marion, thank you so much, and welcome to Profiles. Al, let me introduce you to our listeners by mentioning some of your accomplishments. Al Cobine's big band has been playing for dancers and listeners since 1955. Now, I'm going to take a deep breath because there's a number of names here. Al's bands have also worked for Henry Mancini, Andy Williams, Johnny Mathis, Tony Bennett, Dionne Warwick, Natalie Cole, Mel Torme, Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, Moody Blues, and many more, including Julie Andrews, Bob Hope, Wayne Newton, Frankie Lane, Sarah Vaughan, Burt Bacharach, Perry Como, Cleo Lane, Nelson Riddle, George Burns, Jack Benny, Frank Sinatra Jr., and Elvis Presley, and Pia Zadora. For 48 years of marriage, Marion has been his companion, bookkeeper, friend, and one-person support group and cheering section. Al, explain this. How does someone with a PhD in political science end up being a leader of big bands?
Well, first of all, I didn't get a PhD, but I was close. But to stay with the question, I started out in Richmond, Indiana, where I had a cousin, Bob Armstrong, who had a band. And when I was very young and in high school, he discovered that I could play as well as any of the guys on his band. So I started playing on his band. So I had sort of a permanent spot in a band that worked quite a bit around Wayne County there. So at a very early age, I got a lot of experience working with the best musicians over there. And that was invaluable. Good beginning.
Were you playing the saxophone at the time?
Yeah. I think at that time, it's been such a long time ago, barely remember, I was playing alto. Over the years, there was a great alto saxophone player in Richmond. He and I would play on the same high school bands together and play in the what they called the pep band at that time, which was a little swing band. I think as it occurred, we got a job over in Ohio, which had liquor license at that time, and you could work Saturday nights and play gigs there. Both my good friend and I, Jim Hill, both played alto saxophone. Well, somebody was going to have to play tenor saxophone. Neither one of us played at the time. So one day he appeared at the house and said, "Oh, by the way, I just found a really good cheap tenor saxophone. You are the tenor saxophone player." And he handed it to me. I never paid him for the thing. He didn't want any money for it.
Well, he only paid $25 for it.
Yeah. But I tell you, back then I used that thing was in good shape, and I played that thing for a long time. So I became tenor saxophonist from that point on.
In fact, it was a con. It was great, and you played it until it got stolen.
Yeah. I never went back to alto saxophone. I sort of liked it.
But where did this start, the saxophone playing? I mean, I assume you're still in high school and where you're talking the stories now.
Yeah.
But before that?
Well, I suppose you could say it started with my mother, who was very talented. She had natural talent. She played some piano. She should play had a lot of lessons, but I don't think her folks could afford it. But she was playing, and she started playing by ear.
And then she sang. That's where you really showed your talent.
Yeah, and she sang a bit. And,
around the house, that is.
Right. I heard this and was influenced a great deal.
And you started singing parts with her, naturally.
Yeah, I started singing the second part, and then occasionally when somebody knew the second part. I amazed everybody. They thought I was singing the wrong notes because I was able to sing the third harmony. That got to be a good early practice for me.
How old are you now when you're telling this?
I suppose 9 or 10.
Yeah. Okay.
And you ended up having clarinet lessons. Not many. How old were you then? Junior high school, I guess.
I had to be 10 or 11 years of it.
Well, maybe a little
12,
older,
maybe,
yeah.
Yes. But there was a great teacher over there.
And then you, in high school, you sang mostly through junior high and high school.
Funny little anecdote. The teacher was a big bulky guy. And he played very well and a nice sound and everything. But he always had more air than he needed. So he was always blowing out, like a whale, like extra air.
Very picturesque.
Yeah.
With a clarinet.
Yeah, and he was always letting out the extra air. I thought that's what you had to do. But I found out that he just had excess supply. But it sort of helped train me to utilize, the goods that you had.
So you played the saxophone all the way through high school and then into college and graduate school and so forth?
Yes.
We weekend jobs, In fact, back then, you play one job on the weekend and you made enough money to pay your week's room rent and pay for your food.
See, $10 was big bucks back then, especially for me.
What year are we talking now?
Oh, gosh, let me see.
1950.
No, earlier than that.
50. Well, when you came down here.
Oh, yeah, but back then, 40, 46, 47, it was the post-war years.
Okay. And this is in Richmond.
Yeah.
In Richmond, Indiana.
They had a big recording studio there, too, didn't they?
Yeah, but I didn't know anything about that until much later when I came down here and heard about the Jeanette Studios there,
mm-hmm.
which was a pioneer outfit. There were only two or three studios in the entire country doing what they did, and the guy named Jeanette was one of them. It was like New York, Chicago, and Richmond, Indiana.
And that's where Hoagie Carmichael recorded for the first time over there. And now they're trying.
They heard about it and traveled, taking
an all-day
trip over to,
that's these old recordings.
Over to Richmond.
And they now have a big project they want to rebuild that studio and get kind of a museum going over there.
Well, in Richmond, there's West Richmond and East Richmond. Divided by a river and a big valley there. And all this took place down in the valley. We've gone down to take a look to see what it was like. There's nothing there. Now, there is a marker where that old building used to be. So it's very interesting. That was a pioneer place.
It's a long way from Richmond, Indiana, to working with Henry Mancini and Andy Williams. How did the journey come about?
Well, I would say
the genesis
of it was for me coming to IU. I came here, of course, to study political science. And so since the music school was right there and it was a famous school, I sort of moonlighted over in music school and took some courses over there. I took some vocal lessons, and I was taking clarinet.
And very significantly, you took composition from Bernard Haydn.
And I took music composition from Bernard Haydn. Those were all sort of eye-openers, especially studying with Bernard Haydn. I think I can say that was probably one of the major experiences in my life that changed
things. Yeah, but to back up just a little bit, living in Richmond, you went to Earlham College and got your BA in political science and had a couple of very impressive professors that urged him to go on. So he went to Cincinnati University and got his master's in political science prior to coming to IU, where he was the assistant to Dr. Fields, who was the head of the political science department. Dr. Fields was blind, and Al was the person who opened his mail and read it to him and so forth. And as he was saying, he moonlighted over at the music school. And one of the things he did was to enter the Thor Johnson composition contest that was sponsored by Cincinnati University. And he won it with a brass composition. But he didn't say anything about this to anybody. And it one morning he went into the political science department and there was a sort of buzz going on. He wondered what it was. There'd been a little notice in the paper about winning this contest, and he was a little apprehensive. He was afraid that Dr. Fields would be concerned that he had been doing other things. But he went in, and Dr. Fields said, "Ah, how Jeffersonian." He was very proud of Al for doing that.
Yeah, it could have gone the other way, though.
Now, this is how you get to Henry Mancini.
I was studying poli-sci here, playing some jobs with local bands, sort of to help my way through college.
A fellow named Bernie Vance, who I think still lives here.
Yeah, Bernie
had
Vance.
Had a music store.
Had a music store and sort of ran a band out of that. And he had a small band, and I started making money with Bernie, working gigs around Indiana. He was quite a hustler, and we worked quite a few jobs. So he helped me through college.
Well, yeah, and one of the fellas on the band had come here for a year, was named Fred Dale. He was a New York...
Well, Freddie DeFrancesco was his real name.
Yeah.
And he shortened it, as these guys do, who feel that the name would not fit on a marquee or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
And he from then on, he was Freddie Dale. He started a band.
Well, he was a trumpet player, and he'd had an operation. He couldn't play trumpet for 6 months or something. So he learned vibes and joined this group.
Well, he was a nervous little guy. He was great
and
fellow.
Energetic.
Energetic, nervous, and was driving his family nuts. And somehow they heard about Indiana University and heard they had a really good business school,
yeah,
et cetera. And so they sent Freddie out to IU. And so one day, here he was, and he and I appeared at the same time, and we started playing on Bernie Vance's band together. He played trumpet, and I played go tenor, you know. It didn't take long. I'd say from that autumn till maybe January, that following.
And Fred branched out.
Yeah. When we, neither one of us could stand being there any longer for various reasons, which we will not mention, low money being one, Freddie decided that he'd start his own band.
Well, a combo at that point.
Yeah.
Five pieces, wasn't it?
And he proceeded to go out on campus and got every dance there was to be had. He just had a sheath of contracts maybe 2 inches thick.
Well, and this was in the early 50s, and all the sororities and fraternities had, somebody it seemed like had a dance every weekend back then.
Yeah, so it was a way somebody who didn't have much money could work their way through college. And a lot of guys did in those days.
Well, Fred was also very ambitious, and he ended up out in Hollywood as a member of one of the major booking organizations.
Yeah. In fact, they broke away from, what is it, the big one, MCA? They formed this corporation and proceeded to take two or three of the top artists from that outfit. One was Henry Mancini, and one was Andy Williams, and one was Johnny Mathis. And so they started their company with these big blockbuster artists.
Well, and it was at this point that Henry had all these hit tunes that were, you know, from his movies and so forth. And it, in fact, I think it was Freddie's idea that Henry should go out and perform, you know, go on the road, so to speak.
Well, Henry's already making enough money. He wasn't ambitious that way. Hank was only used to the best musicians in the studio. And he was scared to death to go out into the hinterlands and pick up an orchestra that couldn't play his music correctly. And so one day I just got a call from Fred from Hollywood and said, "Hey, do you know Henry?" And I said, "Yeah." And He said, do you think you'd put an orchestra together for him? And I said, I think I could. And I asked him how big it would be, and he said, well, 40 pieces. And I asked him what the breakdown was. It was like, you know, brass section, woodwind section, 20 strings, 3 French horns. So I thought, well, I think I can do it. But the first thing I did was to check out some of the heavyweights over to music school, like Phil Farkas on French horn and George Gaber on drums. Timpani.
Bill Bell at that time,
tuba. Who was the dean of tubas in the country, was on the faculty at that time. And I called him up and asked if he would be interested in playing a few gigs with Henry Mancini. And he says, my boy, my bags are packed. You know? And he was really hot to go. And so I started off with just a great group of Eager Beaver students, really talented kids, and this sort of structure of
And the nucleus of his dance band was the swing side, as they call
it. Yeah, who were really quite good players, and these heavyweight players that filled in the really touchy places.
And so Henry came out here and brought his book with his couple of guys that came with him, and they had their first rehearsal in the over at the Union Building.
Yeah.
We've got some good pictures from
that. I know that he was very apprehensive as to what he was going to hear. At that time, he started his whole concert with the opening line to Days of Wine and Roses. You know, it goes da
on French horn.
Da, dee, dee,
all by itself.
Da. All alone in the orchestra come. Phil Farkas took a look at that and saw that it was a solo, and so I noticed he was sort of warming up back there, because that opening two notes are the crucial notes, and they're the easiest notes in the world to crack. Do do do, you know. And boy, he went. Buddy.
And you were watching Henry.
Yeah, I was watching Henry, and Henry went.
The look on his face.
You know, he was saying, "Who in the hell is that?" And he looked over. He looked over there, and he eventually realized who he had. He had just one of the best French horn players in the world there, and I was not hurt by that.
Hardly
first effort.
Al, since we are discussing Henry Mancini, how about we listen to the Henry Mancini Orchestra play his Academy Award-winning tune, Days of Wine and Roses. Our musical selection was Days of Wine and Roses with the Henry Mancini Orchestra. This was recommended by our guest, Al Cobain, one of Bloomington's musical treasures. Now, Marion, I have a question of you. Okay. Obviously, you've been around with him a long time. How did you hook up with this guy?
Well, I went to Earlham College, and he went to Earlham College, and that's where we met.
And that's it?
Yep, that was it. He was 2 years ahead of me. He graduated in 50 and was, you know, going to Cincinnati and coming down here to IU while I was finishing up at Earlham. And the summer after I graduated in 52, we got married that fall and moved to Bloomington as temporary residents. And here we still are.
You've been married and you've lived in Bloomington for 48 years?
Almost. In the fall. Of course, this is our hometown, really.
Al, we talk about big bands. What constitutes a big band, and then why do they keep calling them orchestras?
Why they call them orchestras, I don't know. That's sort of I think maybe journalists or people in radio started that. I just don't know. But a big band, to me, the definition of a big band, you have to have at least three or four trumpets, three or four trombones, five woodwinds, and three or four rhythm. That is, three would be piano, bass, and drums, and sometimes guitar. Now, you've got it all covered then. You've got all the instruments that you need to play that kind of music right there. Some people like the addition of the guitar, and some people don't. My problem with a guitar, and I love a guitar, is how they use it. Now, if you use the guitar in the rhythm section as strictly as a rhythm instrument, where he's playing, you know, he's going chung, 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 it tightens the beat up more than I care. Now, if you use the guitar player as a person who's also a melody, so he's playing his melodic lines along with the brass or the woodwinds, that's a little bit different. And the smart ones will use them both ways, and sometimes not use them at all. But that guitar isn't a really fine addition.
When you say woodwinds, you mean saxophones, yeah. And these people can also play clarinets, flutes,
piccolo, or whatever, yeah.
And the trumpet players can play flugelhorns and...
Exactly.
Okay, so yeah. It gives a wider variety.
That's then. Right. And the woodwinds that are really great, that can play all the saxophones, but also, and in more sophisticated arrangements, occasionally you have to have double reed instruments, you know, like an oboe. That narrows it down considerably. There aren't a whole lot of players who can play, let's say, oboe, alto saxophone, clarinet. Those are the natural doubles in the thing. But a person who goes to, let's say, goes to studio work, who can do that, are really valuable players and can make a lot of money at it.
Well, and then Henry required players like that. You had to have for
yes.
some of Henry's things. But then don't you think, I think of an orchestra then, after you, when you add strings to the dance band group.
Well, yeah. To be an orchestra, you have to have, it's a strings. However, in the popular sense, the Guy Lombardo Orchestra, they used it because it has a better ring to it, more sophisticated than just
maybe
just
that's
band.
It. I don't know.
maybe he might have had one violin, and maybe his brother.
Well, and then you have the duo that advertises itself as the big band sound.
Yeah. A synthesizer and a
yeah.
violin.
Yeah.
Let's have a little laboratory here.
Uh-huh.
One of the selections you brought was a recording of Ella Fitzgerald with the Count Basie Orchestra performing Sweet Lorraine. Now, what should we be listening for besides what Ella does?
You have to hear one of the great swing bands of all time with the Count Basie Band. The producers were smart enough to realize that putting the two together would be a tremendous thing to happen. So I think it was just sort of a natural melting of terrific stylists and terrific players.
But we're going to hear a big band orchestra, quote,
yeah.
And we'll hear all of those sections that we just discussed.
That's right.
Okay, let's hear it. Sweet Lorraine with Count Basie and Ella Fitzgerald.
With another brand new choo-choo toy, when I'm with my sweet Lorraine. Oh, pair of eyes that are bluer than the summer skies. When you see them, you will realize why I love my sweet Lorraine.
I'm so happy when it's raining, I
don't... We have just heard Sweet Lorraine with Ella Fitzgerald and the Count Basie Orchestra. It was selected by our guests today, Al and Marion Cobine, local musical legends. Now, both of you have had the opportunity to work with some of these musical legends we mentioned at the beginning. You must have some interesting stories to tell.
Well, there's some I guess I can tell and some that I can't. But,
well, you worked with Elvis Presley, I recall you telling me.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did.
What? But they never met Elvis.
No, they would bring Elvis in like, well, you know, Elvis was the king. And we'd rehearse separately. Then they ushered him in a separate entourage, I mean, with bodyguards like they were bringing in the king, which in a sense they were. But the audiences, the size of the audiences was the amazing thing. You know, we were always playing in big arenas. What, 20,000?
Yeah, and the band was already on the stage up behind Elvis.
We'd be on the stage and it'd be this excited rumble out there. They would start having the big Klieg lights, you know, flashing, you know, like there was an accident on the highway. I don't know, they turned some sound on the microphone.
And then he'd come in on, what, on a motorcycle or something?
No, it'd be a big limousine
that
would
it.
Come in.
On the stage.
With maybe 20 bodyguards on the automobile, and they'd drive up, and he would hop out. He'd climb up to the stage. I mean, you couldn't believe the pandemonium that took place during those things.
And he'd perform, and the really important person to the band was his musical director, conductor, who had conducted the rehearsal and conducted the performance. And Presley really didn't even much acknowledge the band, did he?
No.
Not like a lot of the people. A lot of the performers he's been with, like Johnny Mathis was great. He always would turn and acknowledge the band and say, you know, this is Al Cobine's band. And well, there's a story.
Yeah, but
one time in Chicago.
Well, listen, before you say
okay.
That, let me get back to Elvis. When we were on stage this one time, this was an insane group. You know, I suppose it was just par for the course, but we were sitting there, and this lady right behind us.
Oh, there were people sitting behind the band.
Yeah.
And
just a couple of feet away.
Yeah. Just a couple of feet behind us. And his back was toward us. And she started saying, Elvis, Elvis, turn around. Elvis, turn around. And a whole bunch of people picked up on that. And the guys in the band were saying, ah, shut that broad up, you know, and so forth and so on. But she kept screaming and yelling. Pretty soon, Elvis sort of turned sort of halfway and showed his profile. She screamed and fainted. And they caught her, you know, and it was pandemonium. It was that kind of craziness. And, of course, the musicians hated it. They hated every minute of it.
It probably paid well, though.
Well,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, you were talking about Johnny Mathis.
Oh, well, he was always so good about acknowledging the band. And this is a funny story. One time in Chicago, they were on tour with Johnny, and, you know, there were several days in a row. And prior to the tour, Al had taken a job.
It was probably Henry Mancini, wasn't it?
I think maybe that was. Anyway, there was one night when Al could not, at that time, he played in the band, too. And this one night, he couldn't be there, and he had a replacement. And you know, you just took care of this. You didn't bother the star with information.
The big mistake
like
would be say, oh, by the way, I can't make Friday.
See, this would really...
You don't say that. You know, you just don't show up and you have somebody.
And he replaced him with a fine musician who, unfortunately, is no longer with us, Morgie Craig. And Johnny, at that performance, did his usual thing of saying how good the band was. And this is the Al Cobine band. And he turned and he said, and this is Al Cobine. And he did a double take and he said, you're not Al Cobine. That was Morgie.
Hey, you knew who you were.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is that at that time, Morgie and Al almost sort of resembled each other. I said not only he only replaced himself with a player who could play as well, but sort of looked like him too.
Well, there must be numerous stories. I wish we had more time to do that. You have been involved with IU for a long time, with the Singing Hoosiers, with Bill Armstrong, with the Little 500 and so forth. Can you tell us a little bit about your ties here?
Well, let's see. I think the first ties, of course, started with Bill Armstrong. Bill, for the Little Five show, was using student groups. You know, he was a very ambitious guy, and he'd keep bringing bigger and bigger acts in. He was really becoming quite an entrepreneur without realizing that he was the demands that would be required upon the people performing with the artists. I think one time he had
he realized that he needed truly professional.
But one time they were in rehearsal, and they could not perform the music that was provided them, you know, and which was of course a major crisis, because in those days if you couldn't get musicians to play the music well for the performer, he could walk off.
Well, and you rehearsed the afternoon before the performance, and it wasn't like you had a lot of time to.
I think I must have gotten an emergency call saying, "Al, could you provide an orchestra for so and so?"
And you did.
And I did.
And he did for many years after that.
And that sort of started things. They did extremely well, and from that point on, why, I could do no wrong.
Also, it blossomed into you with your connection with Bob Stolen, the Singing Hoosiers, writing arrangements for the opening of the show.
Yeah,
and that really
they'd
gave
won an opening act or some opening music, which wasn't available for anybody. And so I started doing quite frequently. If we have an artist who was associated with certain songs, I'd do a medley of tunes that were associated with those people. And so that's how we'd start the show. And that got to be quite a good beginning for the.
And those years of Bill Armstrong's support of having Al do these things gave Al the background of, you know, working with a lot of stars and meeting the specific needs. And then Bob Stolz has been a big supporter of Al and having Al write many, many arrangements, especially Hoagie Carmichael tunes for his Singing Hoosiers group.
Well, while we're talking about Hoagie Carmichael, why don't we hear Frank Sinatra sing "I Get Along Without You Very Well" from that album, Wee Small Hours.
Good
that
choice.
He recorded with Nelson Riddle and his orchestra.
Yes, wonderful.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms, of course I do.
A Hoagie Carmichael tune, a Frank Sinatra interpretation, and a Nelson Riddle arrangement. Thanks to our guests Al and Marion Cobain for this wonderful selection. Now, you've raised three sons in this town. Can you tell us about them?
Well, they're great kids. They're all grown up, of course. This has been a good place to raise a family. They all still live in this area now, so I I guess they think it's a good place to raise their families. Our oldest son, a Stuart, graduated from the IU Business School. He's in the tax and investment management department of IU. And our middle son, Andrew, is a freelance musician and painter, an odd job doer. And our youngest son, Ryan, is in technical support at IU Computing and going to school to get his degree in computer science. And all three boys are married. They all have children. We have five grandchildren total. And as I said, they all live in this area, so we get to see them, a lot of them.
Speaking of this area, when you have your band together, Al, you use a lot of local people. Who might those be?
I would be very remiss not to mention three or four great local players, starting off with Mike Lucas, keyboard player, who I think teaches over at IU now.
He does now, yes.
He's a farmer and a musician. He's a rather unique fellow who's not only extremely talented in playing, but he writes and arranges. And he also has a farm out southwest of here. So he's not only a talented and gifted guy, but very unique.
But then also there's Dave Pavolka. That's a name.
Speaking of trombones.
Yeah, that's
he's the king around here, as far as I'm concerned.
A lot of people recognize, who's taught at Bachelor Middle School and has played in the Bloomington Pops and, of course, has been out on a lot of these Mancini and other tours and has been a constant player with Al's band. And off and on player when he's here is Dominic Sparrow on trumpet.
Dominic and I hooked up many years ago. When did we finally decide? Around mid-50s? Or
About 1956, I think, when he 56. Was in school here. And then, of course, he was away for many years.
So it was a great gift to me to have these kind of guys on.
We even have a two-generation Larry Wiseman, trumpet player, who was in school here at one time, lives in Indianapolis. And his young son, Jason, is about to finish up his stint at IU Music School, and he's played on Al's band also.
I want to touch on one thing before we finish. You've lived with the effects of polio since you were 1 1/2, and where did you get the tenacity not to let that get you down?
You know, I've been asked that question before, and I really can't, I don't have an answer for that. I guess you really are born with a positive view on life or a negative one. And I never felt it was, I never was fatalistic about it. I never felt that some unknown evil force came down on me and made my life miserable. And I just didn't dwell on that at all.
Well, and your family, it's just like they took it in stride. And, of course, your dad's, you kind of have that same really positive attitude.
Yeah.
And personality that your dad.
It was probably the hardest on my mother.
Yeah.
Who worried about it.
And she was so busy, but there again, you sort of didn't get special treatment because of it. And then, of course, you had other things you could do. He had this other talent that he could develop, which is his music.
But this is before things were accessible and everything else.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's true.
But he's another thing. Al's just always been positive. He's never turned things down and never said no and just a good person to be around.
Marion, I notice you take care of him, too. But what were you doing when he was out on tour?
Well, that's when he was touring, the kids were young. So I was taking care of the kids. I was one of those people that did not work outside of the home when our children were young, which to me was an advantage. I don't think I could handle all that the way our daughter-in-laws do it. I admire so much. But so I was busy taking care of the kids, and then I took care of the bookwork and all that sort of thing. I took care of the details.
So you were involved with all this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if the guys wanted to get paid, she was involved.
You know, Al, Marion, I wish we had a lot more time. Unfortunately, we've run out.
Yes.
So why don't we end with a 1947 Claude Thornhill recording of his own composition, Snowfall, with the Claude Thornhill Orchestra.
That's great. A favorite of both of ours.
You've been listening to Profiles, an hour during which we meet people who make a difference in our communities. Our guests have been Al and Marion Cobine, the spirits which keep big bands alive. Al, Marion, we enjoy having you with us. This is Bob Willard. Thank you for listening.
The program you just heard was produced in the studios of WFIU in March of 2000. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash. Cassette copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. For WFIU, thanks for listening.